you're listening to the 10x9 podcast. I'm Paul Doran, and in 2011, Padraig O'Toole and I started 10x9 in the Black Box in Belfast, and we are still there every month. If you've never been to a 10x9, well, it's a live event where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life, and we love it. We have 3 stories on this podcast told at different times and in different places. Our first is from Malachy O'Doherty and was recorded in the Black Box on September 18th when the theme was peace. And it's very slightly racier than we're used to, so get out the smelling salts if you're terribly sensitive.
I think I'm going to lower the tone a bit. What were all the world's alarms to mighty Paris when he found peace upon a golden bed that first dawn in Helen's arms? When I was 19, my girlfriend bought me a copy of the selected poems of W.B. Yeats, and I still have it. Jean was a trainee nurse in the Belfast City Hospital under a strict regime at that time. She lived in Erskine House, a sort of mini Divis Tower in the hospital ground. It was policed by a Mrs. Dunwoody, who watched the door each night to be sure that the nurses were back in by 11. Occasionally, one might get a late pass to 1 a.m. These were rationed. Erskine House was really just a halls of residence type of place, but back then, the people who ran it would have seen themselves as having a sort of moral custody of the students. Circumstance was my moral custody. I was living at home at the time, sharing a bedroom with 3 brothers, so there wasn't much prospect of a sex life. Which suited Jean, I think. She wasn't in a hurry for deeper intimacy. She was a good Catholic girl with ideas about preserving her chastity. Actually, she was a wee bit flexible on that. Nights ended in doorways or against a wall in the hospital grounds, in the shade, kissing and fumbling, and some nights going a little further than the night before. This extension of the boundaries was usually followed by a stern reminder that we had better not do that again. I loved Jean, and if I'd been a bit more appreciative of her, I might have held on to her a bit longer. Anyway, another constraint on our freedom was the growing trouble. This was 1970 and 71. There were often riots on the Falls Road. I hitchhiked home up the Lisburn Road after the last bus, but there'd been some worrying encounters with angry people. No one had threatened me, but there was a darkening mood in the city, and sometimes a driver would ventilate his anger or his disappointment with those who were stirring things up and explain his grievance to me as if I stood there in for the Provost, the Stickies, the Catholic Ex Servicemen's Association, the SDLP, the Citizens Defence Committee, and the Catholic Church. People were worried and more grudging of the old civilities. Anyway, once Jean went to London for a week working with the Legion of Mary. Have I ever mentioned the Legion of Mary before? She was doing voluntary work, running a soup kitchen or something like that, helping the homeless, but also topping up her spiritual training. And when she came back, we were lucky enough to have an evening together minding her aunt's house in East Belfast, and she did something she had never done before. Well, first of all, she started working her hands up under my shirt and got me stripped to the waist, which was very nice, and kissed my skin, which was nicer. And then she broke off snogging, moved back a bit, bit her lower lip as if she was thinking about it, and then whipped off her top bra and all. I never knew a man could be so lucky. Apparently, while she was away, she'd get talking to someone in the Legion of Mary about the appropriate limitations a good Catholic girl might impose on physical intimacy before marriage. And she'd discovered that they were more relaxed about these things in London than we are here. But Catholic morality wasn't the only obstacle. That violence on the streets was another. I was a journalism student at the College of Business Studies then, where class discussions were about the riots and the killings. We were beginning to see the effects of a new technology and the nail bombs and the more sophisticated rifles that the Americans were sending here. This was before the introduction of internment and the escalation that followed that. It was a time in which it seemed possible that the whole thing would blow over. And in the pubs, there were the political discussions. A young man like me would get invited to join a Republican club or to march with People's Democracy, join earnest wrangling about the revolution, whether to prioritize Irish unity or socialism. People were getting worked up. What about a federal solution? I was more inclined to think of mighty Paris. What were all the world's alarms to mighty Paris when he found peace upon a golden bed that first dawned in Helen's arms? That was my idea of peace. A bed where Jean might lie down with me and take off the rest of her clothes, and we might greet the dawn, sated and naked, content with life. I couldn't see the revolution being much point if it didn't offer that. Paris, Prince of Troy, son of King Priam, he had his priorities right. It didn't happen. We drifted apart, complicated by a few things, including my early start in journalism going to my head, but also because it was difficult to go far at night. The buses were off and off. The streets were dark because the paramilitaries were gathering up timers from the lampposts to use on their bombs. On the week after internment, I met Jean at her family home in the east, tops off, of course, and inching further, and walked back alone all the way to Andersonstown. Down the Woodstock Road, where vigilante groups gathered in corners, and up the falls, which was in the same state, past soldiers crouched with blackened faces, tracing the moving cars through their gun sights. Nobody paid much attention to me, or if anyone was out looking for an easy Fenian target that night, they missed me. I started work for the Sunday News, and one of the pleasures of that job was meeting some of the foreign journalists who came to town and showing them around and seeing their perspective on things here. The best of these was a guy from New York called Mark Crawford. Mark had covered the civil rights movement in the southern states and said he'd done time in jail for striking a policeman in the foot with his face. He was the first black man I'd ever been friendly with, and I saw a lot of the unreflective racism around him. We didn't even have the word racism then. But Mark and I talked and talked and talked, and one day I opened up to him about the effects of the Troubles on my life. "I can't get a girl," I said. "No one goes out beyond their own area. It isn't safe." The truth was I was drinking too much as well. Everybody was, in shebeens and bars that hadn't been bombed yet. Local culture seemed dominated by rebel songs and a new hardness, by the intensity of political discussion and the fear of being caught in a bomb or beaten up by soldiers. Approach a girl and you might find that her boyfriend was interned and his friends were keeping an eye on her for him. What was it to do on a date but bring a girl into one of those bars or walk the streets and snog behind a wall? Bars and towns were turning people away if they didn't know them. The discos and the dance halls were closing down. Yes, it would have been easier if I had a place of my own and a car, but you don't have these at 19 or 20. Then one day, Mark came into the office I worked in. He had a tape recorder with him. He said, "Man, before I leave, I just wanted to interview you about, you know, all that stuff you said about what things are really like here. That stuff you never read in the papers, about how hard it is to get laid." Jim, my news editor, was there. He said, "Sure, Mal, that's a great idea. Why don't you give him an interview?" And Paddy, the society columnist, who still managed to write about the music scene, though it was nearly dead, he was there too. "Yeah, Mal," he said with a big grin. "Tell Mark about how you can't get your end away. It'll be a great story. It'll be a huge spread. They'll be reading it in New York. You'll be famous." I'm famous for being desperate for a shag. Not a thing young men want to advertise, but I'm telling you now, I couldn't comprehend the young men of my age who yearned for war, were ready to risk getting killed and spend decades in jail, never sleeping with a lover. And I wouldn't have had the courage then anyway to tell them that my priorities were so basic and so banal. But I had Paris, the warrior, a prince of Troy, on my side of the argument. Paris, who didn't give a fig for all the world's alarms when he found peace upon a golden bed. Young people should follow their natures. Make love, not war.
Oh, thank you so much, Maliki. I'm just listening to that processing and thinking, so you walked from West Belfast to East Belfast, then you walked from East Belfast back to West Belfast during the worst days of the Troubles in 1970s Belfast. How horny were you? Dear God. Oh. Thanks, Malachy. Always a pleasure. You can hear stories from Malachy scattered throughout the 10x9 podcasts. Our next story was recorded in June in the Accidental Theatre in Belfast in a special project sponsored by the City Council. Here's first timer Amanda Warburton.
It was the summer of 1976, and the accident happened just like the title of the well-known Miles Davis album, Round Midnight. But it wasn't jazz that caused this emergency, or indeed the somewhat more typical and topical events of a Belfast Saturday night in the mid-70s. No, it was the greatest hits of Elton John. The accident, my accident, as I've referred to it ever since, happened on the Saturday night of August Bank Holiday weekend, the very end of one of the longest, hottest summers on record, certainly for these parts. Saturday, 28th of August. The date is seared, just like the heat of that summer, into my memory. We'd left the pub after closing time, the licensing laws being a little less strict in those days, and were heading back to my house share in Ulsterville Avenue, taking the B road towards Money Ray. I should perhaps say that neither of us was over the limit, alcohol-wise, neither me nor my boyfriend, who was driving. The police had later verified that. But the speed limit, now that was another matter. There wasn't one, and even if there had been, well, we were two 19-year-olds driving a slow road in a fast car. He leaning into me to change the cassette tape as he steered. Badly, I realised, as I saw the dry stone wall looming out of the dark. The cassette tape, the aforementioned Elton John's greatest hits, certainly turned out to be a smash hit with a difference, at least for me on that balmy summer's night. The only hit I remember was my back hitting the road. Thud. To this day, I have no idea how I came out of the car. A Triumph Spitfire, soft top, top up, thank goodness, as this was before the days of roll bars. I didn't feel pain, but I knew I couldn't move. Instinctively, I knew I shouldn't even try. Afterwards, I was told that it was a good thing I hadn't hit my head, as if that wasn't the understatement of the year. Apparently, it's an instinct to hold your head up in such circumstances. Thankfully, my instincts were well honed, or I probably wouldn't be standing here telling my story. I can't remember anything after the wall, but I do recall hearing the panic in my boyfriend's voice. He might have been leaning over me or crouched down beside me. I don't know. I just heard him say something like, "I'm sorry. Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And then, the bit I really do remember clearly, "I love you," closely followed by, "Will you marry me?" "What?" I thought, thankfully too stunned for other reasons entirely to utter a word. Couldn't he have picked a better time than this? Now, I know you think I'm making that bit up, but trust me, I'm not. Suffice to say, I didn't take him up on his offer, though we did, and we do, remain friends, but I never have plucked up the courage to ask him if popping the question had been his agenda all along, and he'd had a diamond ring hidden in his pocket, not his. As it turned out, he'd suffered concussion, having been thrown into the back of the car. Most likely, that explained his bad judgment, because he never proposed to me again. So how long did I lie there on that cold, hard tarmac before help arrived? I have no idea, but despite the absence of mobile phones or even a red telephone box, I later realised, the ambulance and the police seemed to be there within minutes. I can only think that a passing motorist had summoned help, a hero somewhere who I was never able to thank. Before I knew what was happening, someone was strapping a collar around my neck, and I was being stretchered into the back of the ambulance and whisked off to the Ulster Hospital. I felt the jolt of every pothole as the paramedic kept me talking, asking me questions, one after another. Didn't he realise how tired I was? My eyes wanted to close, my brain wanted to shut down, but there was no let-up. He just kept on blethering. What's your name? Where do you live? Where have you been tonight? What's your favourite song in the charts? Who's at number one? Blimming Elton John and Kiki D, wasn't it? Don't go breaking my heart. But never mind, just break my bones instead, why don't you? Irrational, I know, but sometimes I feel like holding Elton John and his flipping greatest hits for what might have been had I not been so lucky. On and on, the paramedic's endless questions. But I could answer them all. My brain, at least, was still functioning. The next thing I remember is the speed of the stretcher as I was propelled along endless hospital corridors, and the kind nurse, who, just like the paramedic, insisted on talking to me. More questions. Do you live in Belfast? Yes, I said. Do you come from Belfast? No, I said, I'm from Strangford. Strangford? You're not any relation of Dr. Kennedy, are you? David Kennedy? He came from Strangford. She asked me this as though I was bound to know him, even if he was no relation of mine. As it happened, he was. Yes, I answered, he's my uncle, my dad's brother. Och, he was a lovely man, Dr. Kennedy. I did my training with him at the Royal. Is he still in Belfast? No, I said, he went to Canada. Suddenly aware this was a bizarre conversation under the circumstances. Canada? The surprise in her voice surprising me. Sure, he should have stayed in Belfast. We could do with him now. A clear nod to the troubles, reminding me that she and her colleagues were well used to medical emergencies, and mine probably didn't even faze them. More chatter, more questions, and then finally, have you any idea of your blood group by any chance? Suddenly, I was glad I'd decided to give that pint of blood in the Queen's Students' Union the previous year. B positive, I replied, feeling proud to have been able to save a bit of time. Feeling also the nurse's gratitude, it was gradually dawning on me that time was of the essence, so to speak. I was wheeled into an anteroom where the nurse brandished a pair of scissors and announced unapologetically that she would have to cut me out of my clothes and, horror of horrors, my very unglamorous but hopefully clean underwear, probably CNA's best. But my embarrassment at this indignity was short-lived as her scissors sliced through my Levi 501s, my brand new Levi 501s, ripping them from waistband to ankle in one practiced flourish. As though she had a Saturday job once, cutting fabric on the tables of the spinning wheel in the city centre. Soon my coveted Levi's lay in tatters on the floor, while I lay in tatters on a very different cutting table. It had never occurred to me that I might not survive. Not until I looked up at a sea of faces, staring down at me. By now, my mum and dad included, their features rigid with annoyance. Or was it anxiety? Either way, I was in trouble. I heard a nurse say, I can't get a vein for the drip. We'll have to get the doctor. I knew something bad was happening because the voices were urgent, then grew distant, and I felt myself floating away, as though I were underwater, sinking deeper and deeper towards a watery nothingness. An odd sensation, not unpleasant at all. I actually remember thinking, this is it, I'm dying. I could feel myself fading away, but strangely, I didn't really care. I knew I should have been fighting, but I couldn't fight. I couldn't summon the energy. I felt calm, resigned. After all, there was nothing I could do about it. I was floating while everything seemed to close down around me. Suddenly, or so it seemed, through the fog of my semi-consciousness, someone spoke. They were saying my name, asking me something. For flip's sake, not again, more questions. I have no idea if I was able to answer, but at least I knew I hadn't died. Nor had I felt the scalpel slice into my groin as a doctor located my femoral artery to make the incision that saved my life. Yet I hadn't felt a thing. Later, I realized my near-death experience had likely been the effects of heavy sedation. Whatever it was wearing off. And now I was swimming back upwards from those watery depths, up and up through the darkness, until my head had broken the surface of the water and I was flailing around, gasping as my lungs filled with air and my head with the promise of survival. The bright lights of the operating theatre dazzled me like sunlight as I blinked my way back to life. Back again, albeit with a badly fractured pelvis, 9 broken ribs, a broken arm, my internal injuries, my injured pride, and a hate-on for Elton John. 7 pints of B-positive had saved me, that and a quick-acting Belfast surgeon. So later, weeks later, and back on the ward, when I innocently asked a junior doctor if I'd be left with any lasting effects, you know, like a limp, maybe, from my broken pelvis, I dreaded that. But he cheerfully announced, "Och no, you should mend all right, but you do realise you probably won't be able to have children." I remember looking up at him and thinking, is he serious? I laughed with him. He laughed back. "Only joking," he said. Hard to imagine that now, looking back from a 21st century perspective. I mean, all joking apart, what a tactless thing to say to a young woman on the cusp of her adult life. Happily, the wonderful medical staff who looked after me for the 6 weeks I spent in hospital had a more reassuring bedside manner. And every time a nurse asked me, "Would you like a wee cup of tea?" I was grateful, not just for the tea, but for all the wonderful doctors and nurses who, in the midst of the turbulence of that troubled decade, saved a little bit of their time and their skill to save me. I was grateful back then to belong in Belfast, and I'm proud now to be back in Belfast. And with apologies to Elton John ahead of his gig in the Odyssey later this year, I'd buy a ticket if I could afford one. All is forgiven.
Thanks so much, Amanda. Elton John has indeed got a lot to answer for. Now, if you like what we do and would like to help us keep on doing it, we've launched a Patreon account. 10x9 is always free, but we do have overheads, so we're grateful if you want to help out. Also, if you want to keep up with all the 10x9 goings-on, then go to our website, 10x9.com, or follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we even have a 10x9 YouTube channel, where we've added pics to some of our stories. Okay, our final story in this podcast comes from Jane Searle. It was told at the first ever 10x9 to be held in Newry, and it was an inspiration, which was also the theme.
Why do we search for inspiration in early memory? Is it that the people who notice us when we are little, who offer us their attention as we struggle to feel important, then become important themselves? My grandfather, John Campbell, has always been important to me. Born in 1893 in the Bogside in Derry, he was the eldest boy of 16 children. Money was scarce, and even more so when his father died in 1912. The family needed a secure income, so John joined the 6th Battalion of the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers and ended up taking part in the first battle of World War I at the Marne. He followed this with a landing at Suvla Bay in the Dardanelles and then later fighting on the battlefield at Ypres. Finally, his war ended early in November 1918 when he was wounded with shrapnel in his head and his chest. You could say that his war story alone would inspire any young child, but Granda, like most men of his generation, didn't talk much about it. He did, however, allow me to poke my finger in the purplish indentations in his skin, where the foreign objects of exploded metal lay rusting. It was for me both a horror and a delight. As a rather squeamish, wimpy child, it pushed me to the limits of my courage, but somehow my granda reassured me and rewarded the bravery with a chocolate toffee roll. He always had a cup of tea in his room before breakfast, and I used to like to take it up to him. Seated on the edge of the bed in his long-sleeved vest and trousers, he would be straightening his braces, his polished army boots on the floor. The boots were important. He had spent his whole working life on his feet. Postman, soldier, swimming pool attendant, boiler man, drill sergeant. He had never spent much time behind a desk. When I was 11 and just moved up to the big school, we began to learn about the First World War. I was desperate to ask Granda about it. He was bound to be able to help me with my project. As I climbed the stairs to his bedroom with his tea and his ginger biscuits, I rehearsed how to bring the subject up. He wouldn't be cross, but I didn't want to upset him. He was sat on the bed, smoking his woodbines. "Put the tea down there, love, and come tell me about school," he said, beckoning me over. "Well, actually, Granda," I rambled, "we're doing the First World War, and I have to write an essay about it. Do you have any stories you could tell me?" I watched him slowly turn his head to look straight at me. He was quiet for a moment or two. The alarm clock by the bed ticked loudly in the silence. I remember being anxious that I shouldn't have asked. Mummy used to say, "Don't bother your granda about the war. He has enough of a job keeping it buried without us asking him to dig it up." "I can tell you a story about the war," he eventually replied. "Sit down there on the edge of the bed beside me." And I climbed onto the big puffy green eiderdown. "During my time out in Turkey, I got a bad dose of malaria, and they sent me to hospital in Malta. St. Patrick's it was called. I was really ill, so they kept me there for about 3 months to recover. And it was during that time that I met a lovely nurse. I can still remember her name and address." And with that, he rhymed it off. "Granda," I said indignantly. "What about Granny?" "Och, sure, it was long before I met her," he replied, smiling with a twinkle in his eye. "I can't put that in my story about the war," I replied. "Have you any others?" "I'm not finished," he replied, and reached for a slug of his tea. "Well, when they got me back via hospital ship to England, I was sent to Grantham, where the rest of the Vickers machine gunners were based. It was dead boring. There was nothing to do. I was missing the sun, the orange trees, and of course, Maria," and he winked. "I had some leave, and a couple of the boys and I went away for a few days for some R&R. We dreaded heading back to camp, so I decided to take another day or two, and I altered the date on my pass." "What?" I screeched. "You forged your pass? Granda, did you not get into big trouble?" "Well," he replied, "unfortunately, the military police sergeant spotted it and reported me. He was such a cocky so-and-so. He'd been a Scotland Yard detective and was full of his own importance. I don't think he had even served on the front line, so he had no bend in him at all. He liked me even less because I was Irish. I think he thought I was thick." "You're in big trouble, Campbell," he boomed across the room. "I'm going to get the senior officer in charge." With that, he went out, leaving me with a couple of other guards who didn't seem to be paying much attention to me. The sergeant was gone a while before he returned with a senior presiding officer. They afforded me a junior officer as my defence counsel, and my impromptu trial began. The sergeant began his statement by stating his observation of the altered dates on the pass. I whispered to my counsel, "Ask him for the evidence. He hasn't got it. I've eaten it." "What?" He looked at me in disbelief. "Look, I panicked and I don't know where I got the inspiration from, but I nicked it off the desk when he was out, tore it up into wee bits and swallowed it. He can't prove anything without it." Sure enough, without the evidence, there was no case. His word against mine, and the senior presiding officer was raging. He gave the sergeant a right roasting about dreaming up false evidence about a young Irish soldier who had done his bit at the Dardanelles in Serbia. I got a few days confined to barracks just for being late back, but no charges of fraud or forgery. Apparently, my counsel told the story in the officer's mess about the young Irish soldier who had outwitted the ex-security sergeant of Scotland Yard. So there it was, my granda's First World War story to me, his young granddaughter. 45 years later, I can still hear him telling it, laughing and rolling his eyes, and engaging me totally in the storytelling. My Grandad John never did relate the traumas of the battlefields he fought on. He must have carried with him the most horrific images of men he had killed with his machine gun, of lads blown up by the mines on the beaches of Suvla Bay. He did write his memoirs. I have them still in this little blue exercise book. A quietly spoken, gentle man, he never wanted to glorify war. He did what he had to do because poverty put him in a situation of having to join up. He was brave, loyal, understated, kind and constant. He never would have told me about his nightmares, but he did write down his experiences, and the horrors are there between the lines. I want to end my story tonight with my Grandad John telling us something in his own words. 1915. We were evacuated from the Dardanelles in November and sailed for Salonika in Greece. From there we proceeded by railway wagons to Monastir in Serbia and had to march from there via Lake Dorian to Rocky Peak in Serbia. The small villages were empty as the people had fled from them long before. It was very tough on Rocky Peak, as we were not prepared for the freezing weather, and to make matters worse, we were only wearing our summer gear from Gallipoli. We were badly under strength, having lost over 500 men at the Dardanelles. However, after a very rough time and fighting a rearguard action under very heavy enemy attack, we were ordered to retreat. My gun section had to stay behind to cover the retreat, and we were very nearly surrounded, but we just managed to get away in time. I remember Major Davies, the commander of C Company, telling us that we had done a good job.
Thanks, Jane. You can hear more about Jane's Grandad John on Podcast 76, Secrets and Lies. And that's it from the podcast for now. Be sure to check out our website and social media feeds. And if you fancy a 10x9 at your festival or your conference or social event, see what we have to offer and get in touch. If you enjoyed the podcast, spread the word. And if you can give us a rating or even a review at Apple Podcasts, we'd be very grateful. And thank you for listening. Also, a big thank you to all the wonderful people in the Black Box, at the Accidental Theatre, and to everyone who helped out in Newry. We'll be back. Also, thanks to all our amazing live audiences, but of course the biggest thank you goes to Malachi, Amanda and Jane. Our theme tune, by the way, comes from the Free Music Archive and is by Fantastic Swimmers, while our incidental music is by Brent Bourgeois, and we got that at Facebook Sounds. For now, bye-bye.